Good afternoon. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for November of 2019. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully it'll be interest to everyone. Well, daylight saving time for 2019 ended on the 3rd, and we had to remember to turn all the clocks back an hour. The 5th was Election Day, and the 10th is the 244th birthday of the United States Marine Corps, who were founded in 1775. The next day, the 11th, was Veterans Day, when we honored everyone who is serving or has served in the military branches of our country. The 28th is Thanksgiving Day. This year is the latest date on which it can fall, and I have a birthday on the 29th. After all the pre-opening publicity about the opening of Wegmans' new store in Raleigh, it finally opened. Scheduled to open at 7 a.m. on Sunday morning, September 29th, with about 3,000 people waiting to enter, they opened 15 minutes early. Both customers and store staff seemed eager to go. This was the 100th store for the Rochester, New York-based company. The Raleigh store ranks as the top opening store attendance in company history. The Raleigh store is the first of five that are expected in the Triangle, with two coming to Cary, one to Wake Forest, and one in Chapel Hill. It took 30 to 45 minutes for that line that was wrapped around the building to get into the store, according to Wegmans spokesperson Joe Natale. We knew there was a lot of excitement, but the outpouring we saw was beyond anything we had hoped for, said Wegmans store manager Hallie Johnson in a news release on the following Monday morning. The city of Raleigh had issued warnings about high volumes of traffic expected for the opening. The company hired 20 off-duty Raleigh police officers to guide the traffic, the News and Observer reported. Despite waiting so long and dealing with the massive crowds, most people were still happy to be at the store. Wegmans reported that 34,000 people signed up for the Wegmans Shopper's Guide, the largest number of new sign-ups to date. Now that things have calmed down a bit, maybe some of we who didn't attend the grand opening will go to see if what we heard is true. Eating red meat is linked to cancer and heart disease, but are the risks big enough to give up burgers and steak? A team of international researchers say probably not, contradicting established advice. In a series of papers recently published, the researchers say the increased risks are small and uncertain, and cutting back likely wouldn't be worth it for people who enjoy meat. Their conclusions were swiftly attacked by a group of prominent U.S. scientists who took the unusual step of trying to stop publication until their criticisms were addressed. The new work does not say red meat and processed meat like hot dogs and bacon are healthy, or that people should eat more of them. The reviews of past studies generally support the ties to cancer, heart disease, and other bad health outcomes, but the authors say the evidence is weak, and there's not much certainty that meat is really the culprit, since other diet and lifestyle factors could play a part. Most people who understand the magnitude of the risk would say, "Thank you very much, but I'm going to keep eating my meat," said co-author Dr. Gordon Guyette of McMaster University in Canada. It's the latest example of how divisive nutrition research has become, with its uncertainties leaving the door open for conflicting advice. Critics say findings often aren't backed by strong evidence. Defenders counter that nutrition studies can rarely be conclusive because of the difficulty of measuring the effects of any single food, but found the methods have improved. What we do need to look at the weight of evidence, that's what courts of law use, said Dr. Walter Willett, a professor of nutrition at Harvard University, who was among those calling for the paper's publication to be postponed. Willett, who has led studies tying meat to bad health outcomes, also said reviews do not consider the particularly pronounced benefits of switching from red meat to vegetarian options. The journal Annals of Internal Medicine defended the work and said the request to have it pulled before publication is not how scientific discourse is supposed to be happen. Dr. Gallant called the attempt to halt publication silly. In the papers, the author sought to gauge the potential impact of eating less meat, noting the average of 2 to 4 servings a week eaten in North America and Western Europe. He said the evidence for cutting back wasn't compelling. For example, they found that cutting 3 servings a week would result in 7 fewer cancer deaths per 1,000 people. Based on the analysis, a panel of international researchers said people do not have to cut back for health reasons, but they noted their own advice is weak and they don't take into account other factors such as animal welfare and the toll meat production has on the environment. There was dissent even among the authors. 3 of the 14 panelists said they support reducing red and processed meat. A co-author of one review was also among those who called for a publication delay. Those who pushed to postpone the publication also questioned why certain studies were excluded or excluded in the reviews. Harvard's Dr. Frank Hugh also noted that about 1/3 of American adults eat at least 1 serving of red meat a day. He said the benefits of cutting back would be larger for those who eat such high amounts. Still, other researchers not involved in the reviews have criticized nutrition science for producing weak and conflicting findings. Dr. John Orlandis, a professor of medicine at Stanford University, said such advice can distract from a clearer, more effective message, such as limiting how much we eat. As for his own diet, Gilliatt said he no longer thinks red or processed meat have significant health risks, but he says he still avoids them out of habit and for animal welfare and environmental reasons. If the experts can't agree, how do we who have less information make wise decisions about eating? How much? Do we eat any at all? If some, what do we base our choices on? I feel I'll rely on the old saying, everything in moderation. I will also use fresh meat rather than processed meat. There are many folks who are thinking ahead about how we'll feed the people in our country as our population grows. And here's an example. Proximity to big markets is crucial for the fresh produce business. So when App Harvest, a 2-year-old startup, was looking for a site for a greenhouse, it picked the 366-acre field in Rowan County just out of Moorhead, a university town in eastern Kentucky. The greenhouse, the largest in the United States, is just a day's drive from almost 70% of America's consumers, including those who love fresh tomatoes. Next summer, when App Harvest begins production at its $97 million building, 285 employees will start shipping 45 million pounds of fresh produce, primarily tomatoes, to grocery stores from Atlanta to New York and as far west as Chicago and St. Louis. For the greenhouse to be cost-effective, size was important as location. The 60-acre, 2.76 million square foot building will be big enough to lower costs on materials, production, and distribution. I asked engineers, how big can we possibly be to operate efficiently and effectively, said Jonathan Webb, App Harvest's 34-year-old founder and chief executive officer. We have to compete with produce coming from 2,000 miles away. The Mammoth Project will use Dutch greenhouse technology, which focuses on sustainable crop production to meet the rising demand for American-grown tomatoes. The greenhouse uses digital monitoring, sun and LED lighting, recycled rainwater, and non-chemical growing practices. It also responds to a host of cultural concerns about food safety, freshness, environmental quality, and energy consumption. Other food growers have the same idea. App Harvest is a part of a wave of new greenhouse construction, changing vegetable production in the eastern United States. Kentucky Fresh Harvest is building a 30-acre, $13.5 million greenhouse near Stanford, Kentucky, about 100 miles southeast of Moorhead, to grow cherry tomatoes. Musi Farms, a Canadian company, just opened the first of three large greenhouses for tomato production on a 75-acre farm in Huron, Ohio. Mastronardi Produce, another Canadian grower, last year finished a 20-acre greenhouse for vegetables in Ohio. The company owns six others in the United States. AppHarvest is intent on meeting the rising demand for fresh tomatoes in a market increasingly supplied by imports from Canada and Mexico. The two countries account for more than half of the $3 billion U.S. fresh tomato market, but production in the United States is declining, according to the Department of Agriculture. Land devoted to fresh tomato production in Florida, a major producer, has fallen to around 30,000 acres, down from 39,400 acres at the start of the century. That's 2000. According to the USDA, similar reductions have occurred in California, North Carolina, and other states. Webb, the son of a Kentucky machine dealer who was raised in nearby Lexington, said he always planned to build something big in Kentucky. Years of research and the state's abundance of land and water drew him to agriculture. This colossal plot in Moorhead is only the first step in Webb's ambitious plan. The next is to be so successful that other greenhouse growers follow AppHarvest to this state. His hope, he said, is to rejuvenate the state's economy, devastated by the collapse of the coal industry, with a sustainable produce hub that could turn Kentucky into the ag tech capital of the United States. The greenhouse was designed and built by Dalsen, a family-owned company founded in the Netherlands in 1932 that has supplied greenhouses for vegetable and flower production in 52 countries. The agreement to build AppHarvest's facility, the largest greenhouse Dalsen has ever manufactured, prompted top Dutch government officials to attend the signing ceremony earlier this year. In July, AppHarvest signed a $15 million contract with Philips, the Dutch electronics company, for the LED system that will provide optimal lighting conditions for maximum plant growth. At night, AppHarvest's 366-acre field, surrounded by Rowan County's dark forested landscape, will glow like a bright glass city. The company is negotiating with Eastern Kentucky Power Cooperative to supply the greenhouse with solar power. The greenhouse will also use advanced cultivation practices. All of its irrigation water, 360,000 gallons a day, will be supplied by rain collected from the greenhouse roof that drains into a 10-acre pond capable of storing almost 46 million gallons of water, or a three-month supply in the case of a drought, the company said. All of its water will be recycled with no discharge into streams or in groundwater. AppHarvest will add nutrients straight to the roots of the plants raised in charcoal beds. The company will control pests and diseases with non-chemical biological methods. For instance, two species of tiny wasps will be introduced to control whiteflies, a nemesis of greenhouse production. In May, Webb persuaded the managers of Equilibrium Capital's Controlled Environmental Foods Fund to invest $100 million to build the greenhouse. He raised millions more from the Value Act Spring Fund and from the venture capital firm Revolution's Rise of the Rest Seed Fund to finance the company's engineering, administration, staff, and startup operations. Rise of the Rest, a $159 million fund established in 2017 by Steve Case, a co-founder of AOL and chairman of Revolution, typically invest $100,000 to $1 million in local startups through pitch competitions, according to its website. We believe no matter what obstacles come up with AppHarvest, this is the guy who could get it done, said J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy and managing partner of Rise of the Rest. We want to invest in people who won't run away at the first sign of trouble. Kentucky invested $1.9 million in a new road and other infrastructures. That area used to be tobacco, said Ryan Quarles, commissioner of Kentucky Department of Agriculture. It's an area that's now eager for new technology. We like his vision. This sounds like an almost unbelievable building. I have trouble trying to envision a structure covering 60 acres. Most of us live on less than 1 acre. In a recent edition of Consumer Reports, the question is asked, why is cold brewed coffee so hot? As I understand it, cold brewed coffee is made by soaking the coffee grounds for about 20 to 24 hours and then drinking the coffee without heating it. I remember some years ago going to refill my iced tea and by mistake filling it with coffee. It didn't taste all that bad, so although I haven't tasted any cold brewed coffee, I can't understand why a person might like it. But we are reminded that cold brewed coffee is different than coffee prepared in the regular way and then served over ice. Why do we drink coffee? Is it a habit, an addiction, or whatever? The most important thing we've learned about coffee over the past 20 years is that there's very little indication that it's bad for you, said Dr. Edward Giovancini, a professor of epidemiology and nutrition at Harvard University T.H. Chang School of Public Health. And if anything, there's more evidence it may be healthy to drink. The benefits are probably due to anti-inflammatories and antioxidants naturally found in coffee. It's likely that many coffee's health perks extend to decaf too, because decaf, only the caffeine is removed. None of the other compounds are removed. Studies have found that coffee has a positive effect on the risk of a variety of conditions and diseases, including brain health and weight control. But not all the benefits have the same strength of evidence behind them. Of course, adding loads of cream and sugar may offset some of the benefits you would normally get. And generally, people can safely consume up to 400 milligrams of caffeine per day, the amount in 2 to 4 8-ounce cups of coffee. For some, too much coffee irritates the stomach, causes anxiety or the jitters, disrupts sleep, and increases the frequency of heart palpitation. Pregnant women, people who are at risk of osteoporosis, and those taking certain drugs should limit their intake of caffeinated coffee. I think most of us know our limits and how much coffee we can consume. Another time to consider moderation. In previous programs, we've interviewed B. Wilson, who writes a food column for the Wall Street Journal titled Table Talk. And here's another of her stories. Let's bring back the proper snack is an interesting subject. Don't eat between meals was a stern old advice spoken to ravenous children. I'm old enough to remember these warnings against snacks and remember being puzzled by the logic. Why it was okay to eat a slice of toast for breakfast, but not okay to eat the same exact toast during a hour in the afternoon. Almost no one lives by the no snacking rule, however, judging from the abundance of potato chips and protein bars in our lives. Yet there's still a lingering sense of moral disapproval about snacking, which is strange, given that most of us snack more often than we brush our teeth. The average American now eats nearly 3 commercial savory baked snacks, like pretzels, popcorn, crackers, every day, and that's before we even start to factor in cupcakes and the soda, the energy balls, and the toaster pastries. But there are snacks and there are snacks. Throughout history, there have been food cultures where the snack is accepted and ritualized rather than viewed with moral disapproval. In Tudor England, the day was generally broken up into 2 full meals, a midday dinner and an evening supper, with about 3 snacks in between. The first snack was breakfast, which was unlike dinner in that it was consumed in private without much ceremony. Between dinner and supper, the Tudors enjoyed a snack called drinking, equivalent to afternoon tea, which might be something like cakes and ale. At the very end of the day, after supper, came a snack called all night, a kind of midnight feast of bread and wine. Maybe we wouldn't be so hostile to snacks if we could recognize them as a small meal on its own right, as many European cultures do. In France, children expect to be given le gout after dinner, consisting of something like a small hunk of bread and butter or pancakes and jam with a glass of milk. A friend of mine moved to Sweden for a year and came back enamored of the tradition of fika, a sociable pause in the day to drink several cups of coffee with a cinnamon bud or wonderful homemade cakes. While enjoying their fika, the slender Swedes my friend met did not feel the need to berate themselves for their moral failings. Snacks are unjustly maligned as a way of eating, argues Mira Soda, an Indian food writer whose latest book is East, 120 Vegan and Vegetarian Recipes from Bangalore to Beijing, a collection of flavorsome and healthy Asian dishes. Ms. Soda devotes a whole chapter to snacks and small things, remarks that she would like to apply for the role of ambassador for snacking. She's not talking about the mass-produced sugary snacks of the supermarket, but the kind of fresh and vibrant tidbits eaten in modest quantities at any time of day in Asia. A life well lived, writes Miss Soda, is a life full of small, edible delights, little opportunities of deliciousness that can be woven into the day. There's no law that says a snack has to be unhealthy or factory made. She points out that in Bangkok, a snack might be freshly pounded salad, the rising smell of lemongrass mixing with chili and garlic. Across Asia, people eat variations of steppe dumplings, such as the gyoza of Japan or the momos of Nepal, tasty morsels that are far more nutritious and interesting than a muffin. Miss Soda's book contains recipes from some truly Asian-inspired savory snacks. My favorites so far are a cumin spike, a potato dosa with a refreshing pea and coconut chutney, and a turmeric yellow Vietnamese coconut pancake stuffed with a bright salad of shredded red cabbage with lime juice and mint. This is snacking as sheer joy. To forsway snacking altogether would be to deprive ourselves the whole world of savory tidbits, from deviled eggs to samosas. Last year in northern Italy, I ate one of the best snacks I've ever tasted. It's called frico. It's nothing more than Montaggio or Parmesan cheese grated and toasted in a pan till it forms a lacy disc. You find yourself breaking off piece after piece of the crispy cheese, especially if you have a glass of Prosecco in the other hand. Instead of berating ourselves for eating snacks, we should allow ourselves to eat better ones and give them the attention they deserve. Make yourself a snack is a good way to find out what you really crave, however eccentric, because with a snack, anything goes. At Prune Restaurant in New York City, Chef Gabriella Hamilton serves a bar snack of canned sardines with Triscuits, Dijon mustard, parsley, and cornichons. No one could serve such a weird and salty concoction for dinner, but as a snack, it's perfect. Sometimes the best eating is the kind we do between meals. In my home, a snack is often fruit, a small apple, a few grapes, or a tangerine make a tasty snack. Thank you, B. Wilson, for your suggestions. In early October, news story announced the end of donuts at some Durham-based Rise Southern Biscuits and Righteous Chicken restaurants. The Durham-based biscuit and donut chain has been moving away from the sweet stuff since spring as the company changed its name. Early last month, Rise locations in downtown Durham, South Point in Durham, and in Carrboro stopped serving donuts. The new menu focuses on the savory side of breakfast with biscuit sandwiches, many featuring a bonus piece of fried chicken. There are a few sweet biscuits with blueberries, strawberries, or cinnamon, but no donuts to be found. The company has 7 franchise locations elsewhere in North Carolina and more in 5 other states. Recently, they opened a location in Asheville that never had donuts on the menu, the company said. And when the donuts are gone, the new Durham and Carrboro menus will feature chicken sandwiches on potato rolls, and a lineup of sides including fried okra, cheese grits, and mac and cheese. Wise merchants make changes when they see coming in the future. What's next? 5 months after purchasing the property, the new owners of Raleigh's ARP Seafood are applying for a rezoning that would allow a new 12-story apartment building on the site. In March, Carolina apartment developer WAJ Management bought the five-decade-old fish market and two adjacent parcels for $880,000. At the time of the deal, WAJ owner Jim Adams said there were no plans for the property, telling a News and Observer reporter, "We are just a proud seafood market owner." But WAJ filed a rezoning request early in August that would be the first step toward changing that. If approved, the new zoning would allow construction of an apartment building up to 12 stories high. In this application, WAJ said new apartments would help close the housing gap near downtown Raleigh. At a condition of the rezoning request, WAJ is proposing that 15% of the apartments will be reserved for tenants earning 80% of Raleigh's median income. In a phone interview, Adams said the project will include around 200 apartments, 10,000 square feet of retail space, and potentially a restaurant, noting that the plans are preliminary. WAJ had hoped that the apartment complex would be larger, but Mr. Adams said the company wasn't able to acquire any adjoining lots pending city approvals. Adams said the company would like to begin construction in 12 to 24 months. So much of this is on the front end, Adams said, of the early nature of the plans. ARPS has been in business since 1952 as a family-owned seafood market, now run by the third generation. Founded by Herbert and Mary Arp, taken over by their daughter Nancy Arp Salmon, and now run by son-in-law Daniel Stewart, the Sanders Street Market has been a destination for holiday oysters and fresh seafood from the North Carolina coast. Mr. Stewart said the new owners have been in contact, but haven't laid out their plans or what it means for the market. "They're going to do something," Stewart said. "They bought the land for a reason." In the spring, Adams said he hoped Stewart would run the market for years to come. Even with the apartment project, he said he still hopes the market will be around for a long, long time. "There is a plan to incorporate the seafood market in the development, but there's no guarantee it would work out. It might be that we'll have to move ARP somewhere in near proximity," Adams said, "but our first choice would be that it would be a part of the development. We shall see what happens." Pizza is one beloved thing, ice cream another. Putting them together doesn't necessarily double the joy, but then again, you'll never know until you try. Step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Pizza ice cream is here. Raleigh's Two Roosters ice cream has created a half a dozen new flavors dedicated to the carnival side of the North Carolina State Fair. And here are the tame ones, like flannel cake and cotton candy, stunners like fried apple dough, oddities like chicken and waffles with fried chicken skin and corn on the cob and caramel. And then there's pizza ice cream, which has no easy category except to say it exists and tastes much like pizza. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the Carolina Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5018. 919-832-5018.